the thing about shame is that this is emotion that we really thrives in silence. And so it's not like other emotions where you kind of exist and live in the world and you tell people, like, you had a good day. You tell your partner, you tell your, you know, I'm so happy I had a great day at work or whatever. And no one walks around and goes, like, I'm feeling so much shame.
That was Nick Jaworski, and you're listening to episode 210 of the Building Psychological Strength podcast, where we uncover the information, tools, and techniques to turn our mind into our most valuable asset.
The courage to face fears with persistence.
Being able to be present enough in this moment to choose my response thoughtfully.
We have the strength to bend to life stressors, to bend to adversity without snapping, without breaking.
There are only six things that contribute to our quality of life, and they are all experiences.
In every moment, we are deciding who we want to be and how we want to live our lives.
Noticing what your brain is doing and then being able to make choices.
Mobilize the things that we know lift us up.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Building Psychological Strength podcast. My name is April and I'm your host. I want to ask you a quick question. Have you or anyone you know ever been in a situation where you have felt shame or felt guilt for something that you don't actually have control over? I'll give you a really specific example that I've heard a lot recently. During the COVID pandemic, especially around times when schools were moving to distance learning or parents were having to decide what option they were going to choose for their kids, I heard a lot of parents saying, I feel so guilty, I feel so ashamed because I feel like I'm choosing, you know, working over my kids' health and safety. They were saying, it's as though I'm choosing to go back to work, and because of that, I'm sending my kid to school, and I feel guilty for doing that because that doesn't feel like the decision that I really want to be making. Now, think about that situation. Most people need income in order to survive. Like, most people need a paycheck in order to put food on the table and pay mortgages and rent and buy basic necessities. So if you think about the situation those parents were in, what they were really doing is not making a choice of, oh, I would much rather work than keep my kids safe. Maybe you would actually feel guilty for something like that, but rather what they were deciding is, I'm going to choose to continue working so that I can keep feeding my kid. And I don't really think that that's something to feel guilty or ashamed for. I think that's actually a really great decision to make when you are a parent and a contributing adult in a household, right? Earn money, buy food, feed your kids. This is pretty basic. Yet, so many times there are these situations where we have little to no control over it, yet we accept guilt and shame for our non-existent role in it, and we end up feeling awful. I use that as an example to segue into the topic that we're going to be talking about this week with our guest, Nick Jaworski. Nick is the host of a podcast called Shame Rules. And it's Shame Rules, P.S., with an exclamation point at the end of it. It's a little bit of a cheeky podcast about shame. But it's an interesting topic because shame, as I came to understand it, as I had this awesome conversation with Nick, is something that functions both on an individual level. It controls the way or influences the way that we think about ourselves, the way that we behave, the decisions we make, how we act, but also at a more macro level, societally, it impacts the laws we make and how some of the most basic things like our school system functions. It was such an interesting conversation, and I'm really excited to share it with you today for a few reasons. One, at the beginning of this episode, we really start by talking about what shame and what guilt are and how they function at that individual level. We specifically talk about times when we accept guilt and we accept shame when we probably shouldn't. We had nothing to do with the situation. We also talk about the important role that identity plays in shame and guilt. So watch out for that, because our identities are one of the most influential things to us psychologically, who we are and what people like us should and shouldn't, can and can't, do and don't do. Think about that powerful influence and the influence that shame and guilt have on our identities. But then we turn to this really interesting conversation, which is really the heart of what Nick's podcast, Shame Rules, goes over, and that is the function of shame and guilt at a more societal macro level. Such an interesting conversation, and there's so much nuance here. The one thing that I will say, and I say it in the episode as well, just as an initial forewarning, we're really wading into some gray areas here. It's interesting because we talked a lot about in this episode our ability to change our mind, our ability to learn and say, you know what? Think about this as we came out of the political season, P.S. I used to think that about that topic, but now I have changed my mind and morphed over time, and now I think about it in this other way. And the way that we react to people who admit to things like that, and the role that social media plays in all of that. Talk about some gray, ambiguous, difficult topics to wade through, but we hit on them in this episode. And I think you'll find it really interesting as you think about how all of these pieces apply to your own life. Think about times when you have wanted to make a pivot or a change in what you do or believe or stand for because you just grew and you learned and you know differently now. And so you want to be or behave differently now, but you run up against friction because you're going to have to admit outwardly that you changed your mind. And there's some latent and underlying shame in that. So there are a lot of really interesting, sort of difficult to wrestle with nuggets in this episode that I don't want you to miss. It's such an important topic for us to talk about. And oddly, we have never covered it on the podcast to date. So I'm really thrilled that we are welcoming Nick to the podcast today so that you can dive into this murky water with us and think about how shame and guilt function in your own life and times when you need to absolve yourself of those feelings because you just didn't earn them versus other times when maybe we do need to accept some blame and accept some responsibility for our role, even though in the past we might not have thought we had a role. I'll just leave that little cliffhanger there. I really hope you all enjoy this episode. Before we jump into it, though, I want to make sure that you have all had a chance to hop over to peakmindpsychology.com/quiz. We actually put up a brand new quiz in the last few weeks where we are really shining a light on a brand new concept that the field of psychology has uncovered. These concepts are healthy selfishness and pathological altruism. These are two concepts that, like shame and like guilt, really influence the way that we behave, the way that we relate to others, and the way that we experience life. I'll leave it at that, but if you're a person who is feeling at all burned out, if you're a person who is spread thin or who is a person of high responsibility, maybe you're a parent or maybe you are in a leadership position at work where there's a lot of people depending on you and you have a lot of competing responsibilities, I would urge you to go take the quiz, peakmindpsychology.com/quiz. You can take an assessment to see how you rate on these scales of healthy selfishness and pathological altruism to see how this might be influencing you in your own life. I think you'll be shocked at what you learn. And then we'll follow it up with some good tools and information that you can use to think about how you might want to do things differently, because that's what this is all about. This is about applying it to our lives and living better and thriving. All right, with this long intro, I am absolutely thrilled for you to meet Nick Jaworski and to dive into this murky pool of shame and guilt that we talk about in this episode. I know you are going to walk away with some really great insight and some thoughtful ways to apply this to your life. Nick, I'm so excited to have you on this episode of the podcast because we're going to be diving into one, a topic that I haven't spoken about on the podcast, but two, we're going to be talking about it in a way that is maybe a little bit unique from what people would expect. So thanks so much for being here.
I am so excited to be here.
I love when I get to talk to another podcast person because you can always tell who does this type of interviewing and it makes it really fun on my part. But you actually have your own podcast. It's called Shame Rules. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, Shame Rules is the passion project of passion projects that I've been sitting on for 3 or 4 years now. Actually, my main show is a show called Where There's Smoke, where we explore self-development through the lens of pop culture, current events, and experience. So if something's happening in the world, we go, hey, what can we talk about through this story? So Shame Rules was supposed to be an episode like 3 years ago. And then when I sat down to write it, I went, oh my God, there's so much stuff. I can't possibly sat on a whiteboard of mine for years. And then on an extended hiatus, I just went, let's do it. And then just have spent, you know, off and on in between other stuff the last year and a half, just researching and writing and talking to some amazing people and researchers and, you know, directors and activists. And it's been really fun. No one can see it that I'm putting it in quotes. But it's been very rewarding to think about shame so closely and to really dig into what shame does, like the work of shame, both individually and from a more structural level.
I love it. And I love people like you who are willing to wade into the water of something that most of us run the other way about, right? Shame is one of those things that is just by nature, it's not comfortable. We don't enjoy it. But that being said, it's an important topic to understand, as you said, both individually and then also how it functions in the collective in our society. So maybe we can start with that individual piece. Tell us just from your perspective, and I'll chime in here with the nerd psychologist stuff, but tell us from your perspective, what is shame? How does it operate at an individual level?
Well, people often talk about, and I am not inventing this, right? I'm just a documentarian, essentially. But people often talk about shame as it relates to guilt, right? Guilt and shame being sort of two sides of this self-conscious coin, I guess we could call it. And so guilt, shortly defined, is I did something bad, and shame would be I am bad. So let's see, as an example, let's say you borrowed something from somebody and you broke it, right? You might, and you did it because you were sort of thoughtless for a second. If you were feeling guilt about it, you might say, oh my God, I feel so bad I did this. And you would apologize, right? Because you would want to fix that relationship and let them know that you feel bad and you want to make amends for it. Maybe you'd buy a replacement. But shame would be, oh my God, I'm garbage. I can't believe I did this. This is so humiliating. I'm the worst. And, you know, that can play out in all kinds of ways. Maybe you'd lie about the fact that you broke the thing. Maybe you would just stop talking to that person altogether, right? So shame is this really all-encompassing emotion that really socially often, there's a rage element to shame too, which we can talk about. But when we think of shame, often we think of its ability to pull us away from others. We want to hide. We want to avert our gaze. We want to not be seen, you know, so that's how I think of it.
Got it. And it, to me, when I, as you describe that distinction, the immediate thing that comes up is the concept of identity that is almost like the tripping point between guilt and shame, right? Like the function of this collective of feelings is that it hopefully indicates that we need to be different, behave differently. And we'll get into all of that, a lot of different scenarios that plays out. But this indication that I am bad starts to get into your individual identity or your concept of who you are. Is that accurate from your?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And it's been a bit since I've looked at the specific research, right? Because I started with trying to understand shame just sort of at the individual level and then have spun out from there. But right, there is this, the idea of self-concept, self-esteem, and shame are clearly linked. It doesn't mean that if you experience shame, it means you have a low self-image, low self-esteem, but it often, they are often connected, right? You know, and you're depending on how you feel about yourself and your sense of pride in yourself, that shame might manifest differently. You may react differently based on your self-image.
Got it. That makes a ton of sense. So when we think about that at an individual level, it's really, and the first thing that I want, actually, before I go any further, I would be missing a really important point if I didn't call out. There's also an element here of sort of emotional intelligence that I want to highlight. So many times, just when we're trying to appraise our own emotions or think about how we're feeling in a situation, we tend to stay at a very high level. We tend to say things like, I feel good, I feel bad. Good and bad are judgments. They're not emotions. And to get to this level of understanding, I feel guilty, or I'm feeling ashamed, or any other more detailed emotion, it takes that level of emotional intelligence. And so I just want to call that out because it's a thing, it's a topic that we talk about a lot on the podcast, because it's one of those fundamental skills that you want people to have in order to help understand their own experience in a situation, why someone else may have behaved the way that they did, why they are feeling the way that they're feeling. It just requires that level of depth of understanding that most people don't tend to get to in just general conversation. So if you want more on this, if you ever go to just Google emotion wheel, you'll get a lot of different versions of them. But it gives you a more detailed view at the myriad of emotional states that we can feel. So I just wanted to put a little plug in there.
Well, and actually, it's interesting because that's, I mean, I'm clearly that's like the right approach. And the thing about shame is that this is emotion that we really thrives in silence. And so it's not like other emotions where you kind of exist and live in the world and you tell people like, you had a good day. You tell your partner, you tell your, you know, I'm so happy I had a great day at work or whatever. And no one walks around and goes like, I'm feeling so much shame. And people don't generally reflect that back to people. They don't see someone's behavior and go like, you look like somebody who's like sort of suffering through this right now. And so if you're able to recognize it within yourself, you're gonna save yourself a lot of problems. I mean, you know, that's that recognition of what is a shame event is going to really save you, I think, a lot.
Oh, that I could thump on that topic for so long. That goes for, I mean, all of the sort of related emotions that we just don't really enjoy having. So things like jealousy. How often do we really openly admit like, man, I'm really jealous of that person, or you look like you're really jealous of that person, in just an objective pointing out sort of way? We don't, because it feels like it's an emotion and a feeling state that is improper for us to have. Like, it's wrong if we ever feel that way. But ultimately, every single one of those feeling states and those emotions are things that come up. They happen. They, like, we all have this complete emotional continuum or emotional experience that we have, and all of them are normal. They all happen. And we'll get into a lot of different ways in which that comes about, but they all happen. I want to talk. Keep going.
Well, sorry to keep derailing this, but it's interesting.
No, I love it.
Talking about jealousy as this idea, right? I mean, is there a connection between shame and jealousy? Probably, but this idea of shame, you know, it's like one thing to feel shame, right? But do you know what's even more shameful than feeling shame? It's having someone recognize that you're ashamed. That's like this weird, like, sort of end, this thing that happens where it's not enough just to feel shame, but it's like, how humiliating is it to know that other people recognize that's what's happening? So it's just this cycle, and the shame cycle is a real thing, and it manifests in all kinds of ways. And sometimes it can be very, very dangerous. I mean, that's That's just like a fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally hear you. It goes back to that comment that you made about how shame is something that thrives in silence. If somebody else recognizes it, they're basically like shining a spotlight on your little dark corner over there and saying, "You, yeah, I see you over there." Yeah, I see you over there. I'm curious. I'm going to go on one end of the continuum. We had a little conversation before we jumped on to chat officially today. We were talking about a couple different scenarios. One scenario is where we tend to feel ashamed. We feel guilty. We feel what did you call it? Like that coin of self-consciousness that has a couple of sides to it.
Yeah, that sounded really smart when I said it, right?
I love it.
Both sides of the self-conscious coin.
It's as though you planned it, right? So if you think about that coin, right? We carry that coin around in our pocket, and there are scenarios that seem like we almost bring those feelings upon ourselves in a way that is. And we're wading in a PS, people listening to this, we're wading into a lot of gray area with all of this. So understand that we're wading through some really difficult to tease apart topics. I'll make that disclaimer right now. But thinking about situations where people feel guilt or shame over something that they had absolutely no control over, they just found themselves in a set of circumstances that played out as they did. And they say, oh, well, gosh, I feel really guilty. Or I feel ashamed for this. One example that we gave recently, oh man, I say recently, but I feel like COVID has really shifted my understanding of what time is. It was a few months back.
Last year, yes.
Exactly, right, right. So we released an episode where we were talking about some of these decisions that people are having to make during COVID. And in the beginning, when we were all quarantining and as the school year approached, we were hearing from people and they were saying, I feel so guilty. I feel ashamed. I'm feeling, quote unquote, bad about sending my child, the fact that, you know, my child's school is open and I am having to send them back there, but I have to pay the bills. Like I have to go to work. And it's interesting because they were, and as we tease this apart, it looks like they're accepting shame. They're accepting these feelings of guilt, like this self-consciousness coin that you're talking about. They're accepting that over a situation that they didn't, that's not the choice you're making. You're not saying you go to school and I'm going to go have fun over here. The choice you're actually making is I'm going to continue making money so that I can support my family. And this is the only way to make it happen. So it's interesting because we accept these feelings in some cases in situations where they are very unwarranted. Have you seen that in the work that you've been digging through?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's interesting. The idea, I hadn't thought about that specifically, but I think that's like really right on. It's like, well, what are you going to do? You're going to just have everybody starve? You know, we're in this crazy unprecedented time. And I think everybody feels a fair amount of, maybe not everybody, but I think a lot of people feel shame over a thing that they could not have foreseen and they cannot control. You know, I think a lot about, like, for example, let's say that I think there's an episode coming up in education, for example, right? I mean, we generally think of shame as being largely negative, yet schools are just full of it from top to bottom at an era, in a time when actually in the early 20th century, as shame was sort of removed from society, late 19th, early 20th, it actually increased in schools, which is an interesting thing that happened. And, you know, for example, you call on a kid, the kid doesn't know the answer to the question. And for some kids, you know, you don't have to know everything. That's fine, right? They go, I don't know. And then they don't know and it's fine. For other kids, not knowing the thing is shattering to their self-image, right? They are so they don't know the answer. And it's like, well, you're in school, right? This is what you're doing. And so it's interesting how it just kind of also comes down to the individual in ways that are biological and some are upbringing. And it is everywhere. And again, it goes back to this idea of it helps us to recognize it in ourselves and others because it just happens so much and it is rarely helpful to us.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I love it. Okay. So we've got this group of situations where, I'm just going to keep using the word unwarranted. Maybe there's a better word, but that's what I blurted out. So that's what we're going with, where you didn't really have any control over the situation. You didn't, you were not making, you're taking responsibility for a choice in the example that I gave that you weren't actually making, and you're feeling guilty about a choice that you didn't actually make. There's a whole other class of scenarios, though, where it is more warranted that we would feel bad about or feel guilty or feel ashamed of our role in the situation, where particularly what I'm thinking about is times when diffusion of responsibility gets in. So if you've taken a Psych 101 class, there is this historical example that they give about this woman named Kitty who was murdered in this courtyard, and she's screaming and these people are killing her and whatever, and nobody calls the police because everybody's looking at this situation and saying, oh, well, I'm just one person. There's all these people. Somebody's going to do something. It doesn't need to be me. In other cases, we look at a large situation. We're like, well, look at all these people who are involved. My one act can't possibly have that big of an impact. So I kind of get a pass for not either acting or making the appropriate choice, whatever it is. We sort of diffuse the responsibility out and away from ourselves, and we don't accept the control and the role that we do play. And in those cases, it feels like we are less warranted in pushing that guilt and that shame away when it might actually be something that motivates us to action. I'm just going to pause and see what your thoughts are on that.
Well, this question of, I got a little distracted because I'm thinking about that Kitty Genovese story that you referenced. You know, I'm not positive, but I actually think that the idea of a bystander effect is very real. I think that particular story has been re-examined recently, and that the reporting on it was not.
Yeah, it was a little like sketch.
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? It's an example. It's like of something that is real, but perhaps anyway. So. What was the question?
I'm curious about situations where we can diffuse responsibility out to other people. It's a way of sort of distancing our responsibility or our role in a situation. And it's almost a way for us to avoid feeling guilty, avoid feeling ashamed that we didn't react or act in a way that would have help the situation along long-term, because we just kind of said, you know, my role can't be that big of a deal. This really can't matter that much if I act.
You know, I have a 11-year-old, and, he's not biologically mine, but, you know, we do the thing. And sometimes I find myself, if he makes a reference to something, you know, that I recognize as like, oh, we don't have, you know, oh, you forgot my piano lesson today or whatever, right? It's not a big deal. I like feel something in my body that goes, you're better than this. You couldn't possibly, it couldn't be your fault, right? Like, and I'm not saying that I act out in a way. I want to be very clear about that, but I have to catch myself and go, it's fine. I just missed it. And it wasn't because they didn't tell me ahead of time. I just made a mistake. And that's like a very, very, very low stake example of just, you know, if it's amazing how often people feel like that they're the one who acted correctly. I mean, God, I mean, how many, it's almost like, I mean, if you ask someone to replay a situation, they're like, why did this? Because I thought this, and that was the right thing to do. I mean, it takes a lot for someone to admit a mistake. And I would argue that in modern times, you know, that it's even harder for us to acknowledge a mistake because we have no room anymore. We have no little private space in the world where we exist, where we can reflect and on our actions and accept them, you know? And that same is true for an opinion we have. It's almost impossible to change an opinion now because we've said it to thousands of people online. And at any point, if you change an opinion, somehow, well, you were too dumb to say it in the first place. Why did you say that if you think this other thing? And no one wants to be stupid. That's shameful. So we constantly kind of box ourselves in because we don't allow ourselves space. And I would argue structurally as a society, we've really cut off avenues of reflection. And so often shame reactions have turned into just a deflection or a rage.
That's so interesting. I'm just going to parrot this back and make sure that I'm understanding this. But as we look at just how visible our lives are, and we make them visible, right? Nobody just auto posts stuff on social media about your life, right? We choose to put this stuff out there. We you know, post on social media, we like things, we share things, whatever it happens to be. But because of that, everything is so visible. And now if we change our mind, it's proving that we were wrong in the first place. You almost have to sort of eat crow visibly and publicly, whereas before you could be a little bit more fluid because there was more privacy and discretion around how your opinion initially was stated. Is that semi-accurate?
Yeah. I mean, I have started to feel particularly strongly about this. I use any bad example you can think of. You hold this opinion, which historically is, let's just say history would prove that it was a bad opinion, and you're in your house and you got your neighbors and they might say to you, didn't you used to think X, whatever terrible thing it was or whatever thing. And you could just say, no, like you could just say, I did. Like you have so many options, or you could have a conversation with them about like, well, I didn't know X, Y, Z. But there's no room for that because now someone can go, 3 weeks ago, you said this. So what now? What were you wrong then? Are you wrong now? And just that, like, it keeps going. And so we as a society have offered no benefit for someone to change their mind at all. And I do think that play out in every level of politics, for example, from everybody, right? I mean, I've really seen it come into, you say, what's the value in telling a voter, for example, that like, oh, I thought this when I campaigned, I now think this now. Because of this XYZ situations have changed. There's no time or energy for anybody to evolve on anything anymore.
Yeah.
Because we're going to turn on them. Their weakness, their like strength of inability to hold an idea turns into a weakness and they're just going to get jumped on. So I do think that is strongly connected to shame, or particularly to the act of shaming, which is another, you know, you can shame someone and they don't feel ashamed. So we tend to, they're just different ideas. And I know I kind of spiraled out here, but I do think the concrete nature in our public lives have morphed what shame does to all of us.
Yeah. That's so interesting. And the implications of it then, and here we're talking about more of a, you know, a macro trend of using social media versus our own individual decisions. Like social media is a large trend, but lots of times within psychology, we ask the question, is this behavior? So in this case, you know, social media being a broader thing, is it workable? So is it, and by that we mean you have an end goal, you have a long-term general direction that you want to be going in. Is this thing pointing you in that direction long term? Not is it helping you out momentarily and in the short term, but long term, is it working? And is it effective in getting you to go in that direction? And so many of these things, they just aren't. And helping us become more maybe empathetic, understanding, seeing the gray areas and things, which most things are very gray. This situation that you've described really is not workable in helping us sort of nudge our way into that gray area and reach any kind of understanding.
Yeah, it's a mess. I mean, it really just is. And I know it feels a little outside of what perhaps we think of as shame, but I think that the stakes of how we act and behave, what we post online, is really our instinct, right, to guard against shame, is natural for thousands of years. It's just a thing we do, but we've never been so public and so permanent about it. So it's such a very unique moment that we live in.
Yeah. There are, and just for the sake of time, we may have to hit this relatively high level, but luckily there's a podcast that goes into depth with all of these topics.
That's true.
But what's interesting about your podcast, Shame Rules, is you really look at, you know, we've had a good discussion about individually. Shame is an individual experience for all of us. We've felt it. We know what that pit in our stomach is. We know what that sinking in, curling up, hiding feeling feels like. You really, though, take this interesting perspective of looking at a more societal, collective, macro level of how shame functions as an entity, like what it does and the outcomes of it. And you've got a few episodes of the podcast out where you've dug pretty deep into this. Can you give us maybe just sort of like hop along the lily pads of a few areas that maybe you've touched on already, or maybe that are coming up in the podcast where shame plays a role collectively? Because I don't think people have really, I certainly had not thought about this until I encountered you and your work.
Well, that's exciting. That's the goal. You know, the name of the show, Shame Rules, it has an exclamation point in the title. We're trying to be kind of like me and winky. And I say we, I mean me. And, you know, but the show is attempting to be not dispassionate, but to be optimistic about the opportunity to discover where shame exists. It's not a particular, it deals with heavy topics, but hopefully in a way that it's approachable. In terms of the kinds of stories, you know, we have an episode coming up on education, for example, and I've already referenced this once, but, you know, a place where I think on paper, I mean, even when we talk about it, I mean, children, we mold children through their environment, through their interactions, through their relationships with their peers, through their relationships with adults. And we say that shame is bad, but schooling in general is, I don't know if it's built on shame, for example, but it's hard to think of a classroom that doesn't have a fair amount of it, you know. And in fact, here's like, in Missouri, for example, it is still legal to use corporal punishment on children at public schools.
That's amazing. I went to graduate school in Nebraska, by the way. I'm from North Dakota. You can't get more north than that, right? Nebraska is like middle-ish. And then there were a lot of people who came in from all these different states, because you go to grad school, you know, pretty much where they let you in. So all of us converged there. And I learned that when I was in grad school. I'm like, what? You can hit kids in school. This is crazy. Yeah. So from my upbringing, that was shocking, but keep going. I had to interject for a second.
I like knew it in the recess of my mind, and it's not used all of the time, but there are hundreds of kids a day in public schools around America who are being, you know, paddled or whatever along the lines, which is sort of, you know, it's not that dissimilar from when you think visually of public shaming. You think of somebody in the stocks or the pillory, right? Their arms and their hands are in the board, and they're being yelled at or whatever. I mean, it's fascinating. Or in my former life, I was a music teacher. I have 2 degrees in music education. And I look back at my whole experience, or you think about athletic coaches or theater programs, right? And the role of shame in as the very core value of instruction. I mean, God, high performing sports teams, music programs, theater programs. I mean, shame is the mechanism to motivate children. And, you know, if you did that as a kid, or if you have kids now, you like know exactly what I'm talking about. It is interesting. And what was fascinating to me actually is I'm doing this education thing, and I have all these friends who still teach music and all these people. And I went in going, we're gonna really like tear it down. We're gonna explore shame in these high performing classrooms. And people acknowledged the shame, but very few people said it was bad, which is interesting. And I had to really think about that. And, you know, we'll talk about that on the podcast a little bit. You know, I think some of it comes down to like elective shame in some ways. If I know the terms of what I'm walking into, perhaps I can stomach it better, which is very different than the shame I might just feel in just by existing right in the wrong place.
Or surprise or expectations or something like that.
Yeah. And so, you know, just education is the thing that I'm just because of my background as a teacher, I'm very excited to talk about. But also, you know, the idea of, you know, we talk about marginalized people in some way, right? You know, and that's basically everybody who's not a rich dude who's white. That's just like a fact. And, you know, I referenced before the call, and I did an episode on it just recently about shame parades, which are a real thing. They were a real thing. They still exist in some way. But just the role of shame and like the church and shame and how it intersects with the legal system. To be a woman in the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s was nothing but a gauntlet of avoiding shame, just top to bottom. And it played out not just because people talked about it. You think about like the Scarlet Letter or something, right? But it actually, there were laws that really intersected with shame being used as control and power that really like did damage. So it's important to be able to think about what shame is.
As a functional aspect. Like by functional, I mean, not that it's good, but like what impact does it have?
Well, how is it being used? I mean, if I were to shame, I used to be a classroom teacher, you know, I could attempt to shame my kids, who knows, you know, Mr. J, shut up. But you know, I could attempt to use it and from a position of power, it has a very different, it is a tool that's being used. And usually when you use something, if it hits, it's going to leave a mark. And so it's an awareness of, it's not just like a feeling, but it is, you know, I when I started working on shame rules, I started referring to something I call the shame hammer, which is like, if you start thinking about shame, you can start to see shame everywhere. You're just like, oh, everything turns into a shame nail, right? That you hit with a shame hammer. But I truly actually think that's true. That's so much of what we do. You think about like the workplace, you think about your boss, you think about your colleagues, you think about politicians, right? Like the ways in which we use shame to separate ourselves from others, you know, what's the distinction between an us and a them, other than that a them is somebody who should feel shame. So there is a lot there. And again, shame rules isn't going to be able to answer all of them, but it has been fascinating to go, God, it's more than just, I feel bad. You know, it's more than something that I have taken on. It is sometimes it's put on me. And sometimes when it's put on me, it turns into, you know, I can't live in certain places. I can't, you know, marry certain people. I can't, you know, there is a work of shame that has thousands of years of consequences to it.
Yeah. There, I'm going to just suggest that we not go down this rabbit hole, but I'm going to put this out there as an unresolved topic because I can't not. But I'm also curious as to see whether it's something you've either encountered or would dig into. Number one, you're right. That is a podcast. It's not an episode. There's way too much to unpack here because it is pervasive. But two, you were mentioning being a woman in the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s. There's like outright laws, right? So my official background in psychology, what I wrote my dissertation on, what I studied the most intimately deep down was cognitively how we encode, store, use information about social groups. And the official word for that is we create cognitive stereotypes. We have stereotypes in our mind, and that helps us evaluate the world and influences our behavior. A very closely and adjacent set of work that I also dug into quite a bit was around prejudice and discrimination. So these views of a lot of the us, them stuff that you're talking about, things that get into sexism, racism, a lot of the isms, things like that. And over time, here's my question. Is there a such thing as overt versus more covert shame? So when there's a law, you, person who fits the description that this law applies to, cannot do the thing because it would be shameful to you, or people like you can't do that type of thing. That's very overt. What we see in the prejudice literature and in the stereotyping literature is things have gotten much more covert over time. There are unwritten rules. There are sort of nudges in the direction that can be really confusing and hard to navigate. I would be so curious from your brain, who's been tackling this in all of these areas, to think about that over time, this overt, covert nature, with respect to some of these topics that you're talking about, because man, I've thought about it for 10 seconds and I'm like, whoa, I could really go down a mental rabbit hole here.
Yeah, you should. I hope you do. And then you can tell me all about it. We can talk about it on Shame Rules.
I love it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just that us them thing, you know, in a former life, I actually almost made a show called Us Them. And my grad work, in addition to music ed, was in communication and this idea of identity, which you've already talked about, and how easy it is to create identity through a pronoun. You know, who is us? Who is
yes.
us? You don't say a them, you've created a them. And now, as we've sort of discussed, I once had I don't want to get into that, but, you know, as we've discussed, you know, it's so easy to say us because you want to feel good about it. And then you start to go, wait a minute, am I saying us? Because to not be us would be shameful. Does that make mm-hmm. sense? So
yeah.
What is the work that I am doing to make us okay because of my own shame?
This gets very meta. Oh man, I could talk to you for hours. This is like getting dangerous here. what I'll say is to start moving us into a wrap-up position, because wow, like honestly, there's a lot of rabbit holes that I would love to go down with you. In the perspective of shame and the way that we've been thinking about it, how do you think about psychological strength being positioned there? Like, we think about psych strength here as being, you know, these abilities and this skills that you can develop and practice. I would love to hear what that means in the context of the work that you've been doing.
You know, I've thought about this before, and it's like one thing to tell somebody, hey, you have to be able to recognize your own shame, which obviously you do. That's like huge. When you get angry specifically, actually, particularly, is this anger related to the fact that I feel like garbage? You know, what am I doing? What's the work I'm doing? This feels like a lot of work, this anger or whatever. So that's one. But that's actually, as I think more about it, that's hard. It's hard to stop. It's hard to slow down. I've really been thinking a lot about how we perform witnessing someone else's shame for others, which is a couple steps. I know that. But the only chance that we have of saying to people, like, look, shame is a natural emotion. You know, there's this tendency now to go, you shouldn't feel shame and other people shouldn't shame. And it's like too much gatekeeping. It's too much work. You know, shame is a real thing. It goes back to the first pages of the Bible itself. Shame is something that is applied to Eve in page like 2 or whatever, right? It is a fundamental human emotion that we have been talking about for a long time. But if I'm a child, if I'm a neighbor, if I'm ever, I am able to witness other people grant grace and space to make mistakes and to own them. I think that is valuable, right? I think it's like witnessing that might be more important because it's so hard to catch it in ourselves.
Mm.
And if we all do that, I feel like perhaps, you know, if you think about your children in your community or your neighborhood, that there might be some opportunities for growth. But it just takes with us owning, like, what can I recognize someone else's shame? And then how do I manage that? How do I accept that and just sort of accept it as a thing? And not necessarily that they are that thing.
Yeah. Oh, that's really good. You know, it makes you think about those situations where somebody does, the political word is, you're a flip-flopper. You flip-flopped on this, right? Where somebody you know maybe has changed their mind, opinion, views, beliefs on something very fundamental, and approaching them from a perspective of curiosity. You know, what is it that you learned or experienced that caused a shift? Like, it's an open, a more open stance to that than, that's not what you said before, let me dig up that tweet and show it to you. I love that as a tactic. That's incredible. We've talked about your podcast a bit. Can you tell people where they can find your podcast, learn more about you and your work? Because this is fascinating. And I know that we have just like eked across the surface of it. And there's a lot underneath here.
Well, I want to talk to you later about this group stuff that you did as part of your scholastic work, your academic work. I'm very fascinated.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can go to shamerules.com. You know, we've got anywhere you're listening to this podcast, you know how to find podcasts. We're on all the major platforms. We do have on our social media, we have photos of people who have shame rules bags that they've placed on their heads and taken photos of themselves.
Died laughing. Oh my God. That is so funny. I love it so much.
So, you know, we're really trying to make shame fun, to really think about the stories. These are stories that we're being told. I mean, I bring on experts to talk me through the story, to talk about the psychology of it, to talk about the research. But the idea here is that we want to just be very honest with ourselves and say, we don't fully know all the work that shame does, but we know it's there. And so let's dive deep. So I would love for people to come listen, you know, because I'm very excited. I'm very proud of the work, which is hard for me to say. You know, that's my own journey. Proud of this show. And I do think that, you know, it covers so many topics that I find it hard to believe that a listener wouldn't have an entry point to start with.
Wonderful. This has been such an interesting conversation. Nick, I so appreciate you coming on, sharing your background, sharing your podcast with us, and talking about a very nuanced gray topic in a way that, I mean, truly, before I stumbled upon your work, I hadn't thought about it from this more macro functional perspective. It is making me rethink so many just institutions and things that we take for granted in society and the role that shame might play in it. So thank you so much for being with us. We so appreciate it. This has just been fascinating.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
It's a simple fact that nearly everyone in the world could benefit from building psychological strength, but not everyone will put in the time and effort to do so. But today you did. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Building Psychological Strength. Now, if you're interested in building the mental toughness, confidence, and resilience you need to thrive through life's ups and downs, visit us at www.peakmindpsychology.com. Also, if there's someone in your life who could benefit from this episode, please share it with them. And if you yourself found this episode valuable, meaning if you took away even one insight that you can use to build psychological strength in your own life, we would so appreciate it if you would drop us a rating and a review on iTunes. The thing is, the more ratings and reviews we have, the easier it is to get this powerful and important content out to the people who need to hear it. Remember, your mind can be your most valuable asset or your biggest liability, and you get to choose. So choose wisely, my friend, and I'll see you next time on Building Psychological Strength.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.